Trend number three, defining American capitalism. As we've explained previously, the economy is at the inflection point between the installation phase and the deployment phase of the fifth techno-economic revolution, or information revolution, which began around 1971. A techno-economic revolution involves changing the basis of value creation and the institutions, resources, and conventional wisdom that supports it. In the installation phase, you start with the institutions, practices, and norms of the prior techno-economic paradigm. In the case of the information revolution, the installation phase was premised on adapting the structure of the automotive mass production revolution to the needs of the information economy. Initially, information technology primarily played either a supporting role, like ATMs or payroll systems, or was isolated in information-intensive greenfield businesses where many existing institutions were peripheral, think personal computers. However, the great opportunities for massive returns involve transforming well-established industries in ways that crash headlong into the fourth-wave institutions, regulations, and assumptions. Ideas about antitrust, organized labor, affirmative action, environmental regulations, and financial institutions are often incompatible with emerging best practices for this new era. The process and end result of this adaptation depends significantly on the fundamental economic values that guide the process. That's particularly true when it comes to defining the roles of business and government. And the full benefits of the deployment phase will only be realized when and where these factors are most effectively transformed to meet the needs of the new paradigm. Ensuring that the great wealth-creating opportunity of the emerging deployment phase is fully realized in the United States depends crucially on making the right decisions now. To illustrate this point, consider the second techno-economic revolution based on railroads. It began in England, but delivered its greatest return in the United States. Similarly, the United States started and nurtured the fifth techno-economic revolution, but we can only be assured of continued leadership if we create the right environment. In the fourth revolution, the New Deal delayed the transition to the deployment phase, just as government policies of the past decade delayed the deployment phase of the fifth revolution. Last time, it was only the command and control mechanisms implemented for winning World War II that forced the United States to optimize for the mass production era. Today, the great challenge comes in the form of global economic competition that threatens to undermine our standard of living, and we must again optimize the foundational principles around which we organize our economy if we are to create the institutions and practices required to dominate the next phase of the revolution. The choice, which is shaping up to be the determining factor of the 2012 election cycle, is whether the country will return to its roots in liberal capitalism or will it take the last few steps toward becoming a social market economy. Let's take a moment to define these terms. A social market economy is a nominally free market system with heavy governmental influences. Most experts consider Germany the best contemporary example and Sweden the most enduring. Liberal capitalism is an economic philosophy that opposes intervention by the government when it interferes with free trade and open competition. The term was coined in the day of economist Adam Smith. The 19th century United States and modern Singapore are perhaps the most well-known examples. The trajectory that the country's economic philosophy has taken over the past 100 years provides the context for the current debate regarding which model would best serve the people of the United States in the deployment phase of the fifth techno-economic revolution. Teddy Roosevelt was the first president to actually regulate with social market capitalism, but it was other leaders such as William Jennings Bryan who, for decades, wanted to limit the unrestrained power of markets. Under President Wilson, regulations expanded and then largely declined under Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. In the FDR era, the U.S. government became highly intrusive, an intrusiveness that grew steadily until the start of the Reagan administration. Through the Reagan and Clinton years, as well as both Bush administrations, the forces of deregulation largely prevented the authorization of new government intervention in the economy. Nevertheless, the bureaucracies authorized from the 1930s through the 70s continued to encroach incrementally. Then, most recently, the Obama administration used the economic crisis of 2008 as a fulcrum to shove the United States toward the full-fledged social market model. And so, in 2012, the stage is set for a choice between these two very different models for the economy. The fundamental question the trends editors ask is which model offers the best prospect for long-term prosperity, a rising standard of living, and the greatest degree of happiness for the most people. To answer that question requires a review of how each system is structured, how each system operates, the objectives of each system, and how people are motivated under each system. In economic terms, the defining ideal behind liberal capitalism is a trust in the individual's ability to manage his own affairs given the freedom and opportunity to do so. It's a belief that when the government stays out of the way, entrepreneurs will unleash their innovative energies, which leads to economic growth. Ideas compete and evolve through a process much like natural selection. Market forces, that is, people voting with their dollars, administer rewards, which is arguably the most efficient and fair method for determining economic winners and losers. It is not arbitrary, nor is there patronage. Products and services are chosen or passed over based solely on their ability to deliver benefits. And what is considered a benefit is determined by the consumer, not a bureaucrat. Another significant element of liberal capitalism is the ability for private equity investors, which might be wealthy individuals, pension funds, or insurance companies, to place their capital wherever they feel it will be most profitable. And this is where the true power of capitalism lies. A positive synergy exists among the various players in the capitalistic market. In seeking a profit for themselves, these investors provide the resources that companies need to innovate and grow, creating jobs that people need and products and services that enrich consumers' lives. Under this system, ingenuity and hard work are rewarded, which motivates people to live up to their potential. And it is in this regard that liberal capitalism is misunderstood or purposefully misrepresented, and this gives it a bad name. Many have come to believe that this system is about materialism, when in fact that is not the goal. It is true that many individuals operating in this system are caught in that trap. However, this is not the intended result. Rather, human flourishing is the desired outcome. It is about people achieving self-esteem and self-actualization, as described by Maslow in his Hierarchy of Needs. This comes about by promoting equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome, and seeking to stimulate true prosperity as opposed to simply treating poverty. In short, the two cornerstones of liberal capitalism are trust in the individual and the ability for investors to freely choose where to place their capital for the best return. A key mechanism that makes this model work so effectively is a process called creative destruction. There's no doubt that this process also contributes to liberal capitalism getting a bad name in many circles. It's a simple enough concept. In the ongoing creative effort of individuals and companies to capture markets with new and improved products and services, older and obsolete products and even industries are destroyed. When the focus is on the destruction of industries and loss of jobs, liberal capitalism appears to be a heartless process that values economic gain over people. But taken as a whole, this is not the case, because in virtually every instance, the new products that replace the old deliver vastly more benefits to a wider segment of people, both by providing more and better-paying jobs and by providing products that offer more benefits than the ones they replaced. For example, think how superior the light bulb is compared to an oil lamp, or an iPod compared to a phonograph, or a PC to a typewriter. In each case, the oil lamp, phonograph, and typewriter manufacturers felt the destruction, while the public embraced the creativity. Private equity investors cause similar creation-destruction scenarios when they choose to reallocate capital to situations where it will be the most effective, moving it from less productive uses to more profitable ones. It has been the willingness of the U.S. to endure and even embrace this kind of creative destruction that has enabled our economy to outperform every other economy for decades. There's no reason to believe that this economic model that creates competition, which spurs innovations that lead to economic growth, won't continue to deliver these same benefits in the future, if given the chance. In contrast to liberal capitalism, government plays a central role in the social market model, heavily influencing, if not defining, many components of the economy through regulation and outright ownership. Under this model, the government plays the part of the economy's tutor, using public funds to stimulate and guide it. This model is characterized by ever-expanding bureaucracies, a managed economy, and large-scale income redistribution. Unions, both in the private and public sectors, are strong, dictating in many cases the size and scope of companies' workforces, as well as the terms for cutting those workforces. Although this system falls short of full-scale socialism, where the government owns all the means of production, it is certainly edging toward a cradle-to-grave welfare state. The difference is that under the social market model, enough private industry is tolerated to fund big social programs. For this reason, some people believe the social market model represents the best of both worlds. For most of America's history, our economy operated under the liberal capitalism model, yet we are clearly edging toward a social market economy. To confirm this statement, one needs to look no further than the $829 billion 2009 stimulus package, the massive auto industry bailouts of Chrysler and GM, the enormous government-sponsored enterprises behind the housing bubble, like Fannie Mae, President Obama's Affordable Care Act, and our recent subsidies for risky alternative energy ventures. It's also abundantly clear that the current administration would like to take the country further down this path. As the president said, only government can provide the short-term boost necessary to lift us from a recession this deep and severe. Only government can break the cycle that is crippling our economy. Despite claims to the contrary and its prevalence in Europe, a simple analysis reveals that the social market model is a poor choice when it comes to delivering long-term prosperity, a rising standard of living, and the greatest degree of happiness for the most people. And that is not only true for our country, but for almost any country. The weakness of the social market model, where benefits for a growing number of citizens are funded by money that is taken from a decreasing number of their fellow citizens, is that eventually a tipping point is reached where there are too many takers and not enough makers. This is the current state of Greece, and that increasing imbalance is driven by one word, disincentive. As the government grows, there are more opportunities for corruption and payoffs to special interest groups, meaning economic rewards become less and less merit-based and more dependent on political connections. Furthermore, in the name of fairness, there is a push for income equality, which is a huge disincentive for working harder and smarter. Additionally, under this system, the government moves in to protect out-of-date products, companies, skill sets, and ways of doing business, which undermines the power of creative destruction. These factors combine to derail growth in productivity and hence growth in the economy. In human terms, the difference between the two models is at least as stark as the economic differences. Why? Because study after study has confirmed that happiness derived from personal achievement far exceeds that derived from unearned benefits. In fact, simply increasing material benefits seems to quit adding any value above about $25,000 a year per capita. The result? A social market economy foments disillusionment among those who are continually on the receiving end of unearned benefits and have no incentive to pull themselves up. When added to the discouragement on the part of the producers, who see more and more of their rewards taken with diminishing results, the impact is corrosive to society. Meanwhile, under liberal capitalism, where achievement is prized, whether it's building a multi-billion-dollar company or simply providing for one's day-to-day needs through hard work, earned success leads to greater satisfaction and greater happiness in life. The choice is becoming starkly clear, and soon Americans will decide which path they'll follow into the final, most crucial stage of the information revolution. Considering this trend, we offer the following forecasts. First, liberal capitalism will triumph over the social market model in the United States, but getting there will involve confrontations at many levels. Americans still strongly support free enterprise. According to a recent Gallup poll, 86% of Americans view free enterprise positively. This is not surprising, since it has been at the core of our history and national character. However, the factor that will eventually tip the scales is that liberal capitalism produces results that are superior to those of a social market economy. For instance, it's important to show people how social market institutions like Fannie Mae, industry subsidies, and stimulative Federal Reserve policies created the housing crash, not the workings of liberal capitalism. The problem is that the rewards of the social market model go disproportionately to a vocal minority that will attempt to delay change at every turn. Second, the move toward liberal capitalism will accelerate as people experience and understand the net benefits of creative destruction. The inflection point of a techno-economic revolution is probably the hardest time to deliver that message. It was Milton Friedman who observed that a business closing down typically gets major news coverage, at least locally, while there's no coverage of the reallocated capital and the jobs it creates, because the jobs are so widely dispersed. But that's precisely when it's most important for people to understand that the government helping save a dying sector does more harm in the long run than letting markets force the company into bankruptcy. It's also when we need to articulate a clear-cut vision for those who are displaced by creative destruction. That involves putting in place mechanisms to assist people in transitioning from old industries to new ones.